And he said, I was very uncomfortable. And he said, I kind of reviewed some things in my mind, and then I was kind of whisked back, and I came back. He had another near-death experience after that. I was just telling Dr. Flew today, when I was up in Canada teaching recently, a person showed me an article from a British journalist who said that, and the article implied, that in the last year of his life, in the last year between these near-death experiences and when Dr. Ayer did pass away, the journalist implied that Dr. Ayer converted to Christianity, and what he said was he became friends with a very well-known Jesuit philosophical scholar, F.C. Copleston, and a guy whose history of philosophy books, excellent books, are still read and studied today. And they were antagonists throughout their life, but in the last year of his life, they became very close friends, and Dr. Copleston would visit Dr. Ayer regularly after this near-death experience. But before all that, before the Copleston visits, Dr. Ayer said at the end of his article, what I saw when I died, he said at the end of the article, he said, I had this near-death experience. I kind of think there were some things there that were true. I'm more open to life after death than I ever have been before. And he said, but to all my friends in America, this article was published in an American magazine. He said, to all my friends in America, don't worry, I'm still an atheist. And that's how he ended his article. Although, like I said, subsequently he started meeting with this Jesuit philosopher, and they got to be very good friends. Now, let me say for last, I'm not saying this is the best case, but it might be the most interesting case. A book was published in 1998 called Light and Death. The author of the book is Michael Sabon, the cardiologist whom I discussed a little while ago. He is still said to have written the best scientific book on this subject. It's a 1982 book with Harper and Row, and it's called Recollections of Death, A Medical Perspective. Recollections of Death, A Medical Perspective. Because he's got statistics and how many people had this and what kind of experiences they had. He had a control group, and he reported what these people saw versus what the NDEers saw. And the NDEers, by the way, were more accurate than the control group who had open heart surgery. So all this is in the book, and it's a very scientific look at this. And this book has been praised for being very careful and everything else. Mike Sabon is one of the scholars, one of the scientists, who gave the name near-death experience to the experience. Well, in 1998, he did a follow-up book. It's called Light and Death. And in this book, he said this. He said, in 1982, we called these things near-death experiences, and we couldn't get more exact than that. But he says, as science gets more and more exact, our definitions do also. And he said, because of these instruments we have and the abilities we have right now, he said, since that time, we have some post-death cases. You think, whoa. For this guy who's been so particular in 1982 to say, that's near death, that's near death, that's near death, how come the guy's going to say now, here's an after-death experience? Well, he tells the story of an Atlanta housewife in her 30s, and she had a brain aneurysm. I do not know if this is still true, but at the time, I believe, there was only one person in the world who did the kind of surgery I'm going to describe, and that Dr. Sabon takes a chapter to describe. And it's a medical doctor in Phoenix, Arizona. And they flew her to Phoenix. And what the doctor does is this. He cuts into the skull for brain aneurysm. And if the vessel is right there on top, he repairs it, puts things back together. And, you know, usually there's very positive results. But they really don't know till they get in. And if the vessel they have to repair is very deep in the brain, they can't work on it. And so what they do is institute a practice that's come to be known as, quote, Operation Standstill, quote, unquote, which colloquially you'd say they kill the patient. They have to shut this person's body down in order to get into their brain. So with her on the table, he opened up her skull, and he ascertained that this blood vessel was too far in there, and they couldn't work on it. So they had to cool her body down to 59 degrees. They drained all the blood out of her head. They recycled it. And they manually stopped her heartbeat. and then her brain shut down just a short time later. And she was in the state, she was in surgery for several hours, and she was in this state for well over an hour where she had no heartbeat and no brainwave activity. And she said, when he started cutting, she said she came out, she said, and I watched the rest of the procedure as if I were sitting in his lap or looking over his shoulder. And she started reporting things about the room. And she said, I saw this and I saw this. And she said, hey, doctor, what was that saw thing you were using? And he said, draw it. So she takes her pen and she draws this picture. And she said, I pictured some kind of thing with a great big saw on the end of it. And she said, it looked like a pen, just a regular pen. And he said, draw it. So she draws this thing. You can, there's drawings in the book. And it looks like a pen with a little half moon opening and a little tiny, whatever, little blade right here. And you can see the drawing in the book, and you can see the photograph of the tool. And she said, what was that thing looking like a lug wrench set next to you? And he said, lug wrench? And she said, yeah, sit on the table next to you. And he said, draw it. And she draws this thing, and it looks like a, you know, adjustable wrench set where you undo one side and open it up, and they're all... And what she was drawing, of course, was interchangeable saw heads for this. And she drew a picture of that, and they show you. And so she describes the saw. She describes the blades. She'd never seen these things. They tried to go into her right femoral artery. They couldn't get in there. They couldn't get into the vein. So as a cardiologist, there were a team of more than a dozen people in the room that had to work on her and keep everything set during the surgery. And they couldn't get into her right artery, so they had to go to the left side. Well, this is all during this time when she shouldn't have been reporting anything. She said, they moved over to the left artery. That was okay. She gave the name of the doctor who decided on the process. This doctor's name, well, when later, when Dr. Sabom got the notes of the surgery, this whole thing was described. They couldn't go on the right. They had to go on the left. Here's the doctor who said it. All told, she mentioned 6 coaborative points while she shouldn't have been reporting anything. Now, here's the thing about flat brainwave activity. You can have flat brainwave activity and recover. It's very, very rare, but it happens. But if we are physical beings and there's nothing that outlives the death of our body, and the body is shut down such that there's no brainwave activity or heart activity, then during that time, especially if it's for an hour, during that time, even if something's going on right in front of you, you're not reporting it because you're not, quote, recording it. You're not, you know, things aren't connecting. So it's not a matter of, well, her ears were still working or something like that, because if your brain's not working, your heart's been shut down, she shouldn't be reporting anything. And she reported 6 things in this state, and one of them, this one's really interesting, one of them is a politically incorrect joke told by one of the male doctors in the room. Now, I was sent an advanced copy of the manuscript, a loose-leaf copy, and asked to write a blurb for the back cover, which I did. But when the book came out, the joke had been excised from the pages of the manuscript because it was politically incorrect. But I have the pre-pub manuscript copy with the joke in it. And here's what happened. When the doctor came to her room, when she came out of the surgery, the doctor who made the joke came to her room, and she said, did you say this about me? And she reported the joke. And she knew all this, and she knew what he'd said, and she wasn't mad at him. She liked this guy. She was a little disturbed that he'd said it, but she liked the guy. And so they kind of laughed and kind of cut up about it. But she could report the joke to him during this time. Now, I should tell you what happened at the end of this. While this was going on, and the deeper the experience went, and as she went into this dead-as-dead-can-be state, she was watching the surgery, and she zipped off. And she said, I went down this tunnel, and I went to this beautiful place, and I wanted to keep going, and they wouldn't let me there. She was talking to some of my deceased relatives. Okay, there's no test for this. There's no test for this kind of stuff. But very frequently when a near-death person tells you something about, if they describe, quote, heaven, they will tell you about a boundary. It's a river. It's a lake. It's a mountain range. One woman told me it was an escalator. That's interesting. In heaven, an escalator in heaven. There's some kind of a boundary. It's a fence. And if they go beyond it, they're told they can't go further and return. So this lady is watching this, and she's saying, what's over there? Oh, you can't go in there. Oh, I want to go over there. You can't go there. And she'd take a step this way, and her uncle kept stepping in front of her. Say, you can't go there. He was deceased. This is what she said. And he'd step in front of her, and he wouldn't let her go around. And when she came back, she had this long experience, starting with the six corroborative things in the room and the joke that was told and what was done and what the room looked like and all the stuff and the saw blades and then zipping away. And like I said, there's no test for heaven. But I'll tell you this, there's no test for hell either. I mean, there's no empirical data that these people were in those places. What's most interesting, though, philosophically, I think, is the brain state. If this is a brain state where the brain's not working, but the person's making profound observations, they make them as soon as they come to, so someone doesn't give them this data over time. They start telling the story as soon as they come true, as soon as they come to, and it's in their report, or it's what the room looked like. They can verify a joke that other 15 other people in the room remember. Things like this. This indicates to me that something beyond a physical brain is operating here. Now, in one of the books, the titles you heard before I came up here, J.P. Moreland and I did a couple of books on death and dying and some of this material. And I don't think this is evidence per se of heaven or hell, because we don't have evidence at that stage, you know what I mean, out there. We don't have experience from her uncle and what he was doing because he was deceased, right? But it's interesting, these people are claiming at least to have these kinds of experiences. And that this worldly side of it, the things they can report down here, seem to be, you can check it out. You can check reports out. And sometimes we have overlap with reports, like a car accident and an EMT's report. We have a police report and an EMT report, where you see things lining up and the person tells you what's going on, but they were not any kind of a state to report this. And we concluded, I hope carefully, but we concluded for what we called minimalistic life after death. By minimalistic life after death, we mean not the furniture of heaven or hell, but minutes, or in some cases, hours after death. That's all we are. The case of Katie, the girl from Idaho, 3 days. But it's minimal because you can't talk about, some of these people report demons, some of these people report angels. We don't have any test for that sort of thing. That's just their experience. But the part that can be checked out when it's after the heart being not beating for so long, the brainwave not working for so long. I'm going to bring this to a close here in the next 5 minutes and ask if you have any questions. But, you know, what's most interesting about talking to some of these near-death cases is, I will go ahead and say this first. On the back of your sheet is some stuff about the resurrection. It's not my purpose to chat about that tonight, but let me put a plug in for our discussion tonight. Dr. Flew and I are in this room up here, I understand, for a friendly dialogue on the resurrection tonight. I think the evidence for near-death experiences, I think is very, very interesting. The resurrection is a different category of data, and that would purport. I mean, we're talking about Jesus. We are talking about some of the data about heaven, hell, and so on. But I'll just put a plug in for tonight's, Chuck, 8 o'clock, right? 8 o'clock tonight in this room. Okay, let me end with this. When you interview a person with a near-death experience, in spite of how evidential some of these cases might be, and you're sitting there and you're scribbling like mad and things where you think you can check this worldly kind of events out when they're in states where they shouldn't be able to report this, it's really interesting because sometimes what the person says that can't be verified kind of tugs at your heart a little bit more than what people say that can be verified. Now, there's no verification. It's just that there's some experience level here that kind of gets you. Now, certainly this man who had 7 heart attacks and said he was in hell is an interesting case. There are, the hell cases of that nature are fairly rare, but there are a number of them, and there's different kinds of hell type cases, or let's just say negative cases. The people call them hell, but negative cases. But the positive cases can have a really, really profound effect on a person, even if there's no evidence. Now, one time I was speaking to a group of medical doctors, and we were in a room like this, and I was speaking about near-death experiences to medical doctors, and there was a woman down here in front who was a professor at the University of Illinois Medical School. And she said to me during the afternoon, I was doing a bunch of things that weekend with these medical doctors, and we had a break in the afternoon, and she walked past me, and I was reading a book outside, and she walked past me, and she said, "I don't know what you're going to do in that near-death lecture tonight, but I just can't even imagine that you're going to have some evidence for life after death that we're going to be able to say, this is good evidence." Well, I said, "Yeah, wait and see. I'll be glad to hear what you have to say." So we were given this lecture, and she told me later she had absolutely no response to these evidential cases. But when I was done, there was a woman over here on this side of the room, and she was the wife of ear, nose, and throat specialist. This happened in Wisconsin, but interestingly enough, her husband was a Stanford grad, ear, nose, and throat. And she raised her hand at the end of my lecture, and she said, "I've been to heaven." Now, standing from my viewpoint, you have to see these medical doctors, and everybody in the room, they turn and they look over at her. And the woman down here in front from University of Illinois Medical School kind of yells across the room and says, "Just don't sit there. Tell us about it." And this woman said, "I was delivering my third child. I don't know what the reason is, but I have a number of, probably a half dozen cases, childbirth stories. And she was delivering the third child, and she said, you know, I reached a tough time in the delivery, and I was in a crisis, and I zipped away to heaven." No evidence. She zipped away to heaven, and I said to the group, I said, "All right, listen, I'll do a quick little interview with her, and let me show you what an interview with a near-death patient looks like." And I had never talked to her about this before, so I started asking her questions. "Was there a boundary?" "Yep, there was a stream, and I couldn't go past the stream." I said, "Oh, yeah? Well, what did it look like?" And here's how near-death patients typically describe what they call, you know, heaven or whatever this beautiful place is that they are. They'll say like this. They'll say, "Well, I was in this most incredible place, and the colors, oh, I wished I could the colors were like, no, I can't do it, because when you think I mean colors, you're thinking about colors like here, but this isn't it. This is color you could like walk into and you could touch color and you could, no, I know I'm not doing a good job. And the music is the most incredible music I ever heard. And no, because see, when I say music, you're thinking about the Beatles or something, and I'm just, no, never mind, I'm not doing a very good job." And this is called ineffability, the inability to, so they're talking about colors and music. And she said, I just really enjoyed it. I wanted to get past that river, and they wouldn't let me go. I said, "Okay, let me ask you in front of the whole group." I said, "You just delivered your third child." "Yes." I said, "I've always heard it said that the strongest biological bond in the universe is between a mother and her child." And she said, "Okay, I'll grant that." I said, "For the sake of this group, tell me something. Did you want to stay, or did you want to come back?" And she kind of looked down a little bit, and she said, "I didn't want to come back." And she elbowed her husband kind of playfully, and she said, "He can raise the kids." And I said, "Just okay, let me ask you again. You're the mother of your third child. You're close to these kids. It's a newborn. You haven't had any time with this child. And you would rather stay there." She said, "Absolutely." I said, "Let me ask you something. Are you afraid to die?" And she said, "Look, I'm not hoping it's going to happen to me today or something. But," she said, "I'll tell you what, I'm looking forward to it. Yes, I'm looking forward to it. I have absolutely no fear." Now, when you hear some people talking like that, I can't say, "Well, how many points of evidence did you have?" You know, some of them, the Atlanta housewife, she wanted to go beyond that point too, and her uncle wouldn't let her go. But I'm just saying, in closing, that some of these people, their experience is more interesting sometimes than the black and white sort of answers they can give. And when you say, well, tell me this or that, and you walk away, you've got that evidence down there that you can check out. But it doesn't affect you the same way the person's, the look in their eye or their words has more of an effect on you. And I'll say, sort of like a dream, huh? And they'll say, dream? I am more sure that I was there than when I went to the supermarket today to get a Coke. I am more sure I was there. It's the most real experience I've ever had. Now, in cases where people have data, that's even more interesting. Well, I'm going to leave you with this and see if you have some questions. I can tell you, this is quite an interdisciplinary project, too. There are near-death studies from China, from India, from England. They are very similar in a lot of respects. I know of a study, 600 largely Hindus in India with near-death phenomena. I know of a couple studies in Chinese culture, one of them among Buddhists. So pretty interesting. Okay, questions, comments? Yes. Well, in the Hindu study, the Buddhist study was pretty small compared to the Hindu one. The Hindu study had 600, so it was good size. The conclusion of the two psychologists who did the investigation is that the Hindu, some of the reports are undoubtedly sociological. For example, Hindus reported seeing more, they thought people they saw, these persons that they would say, like, you know, in heaven or whatever, or wherever they thought they saw them, they report more religious persons, whereas Westerners report more people. You know, my aunt. Americans see more women than men. It's something like 60-40 or 55-45. But the Hindus saw very few women. And you could argue that's part of their culture, that kind of stuff. And here's one of the more interesting things. There were more negative experiences with the Indian cases. I say Indian, from India, cases, whatever their religion. There were more negative cases. And a lot of the cases, there were cases they came to call takeaway experiences, where the person would tell a doctor, the angel of death visited me today, and I'm going to die tonight. And the doctor said, nonsense. You're doing fine. We're going to have you out of here in a couple of days. He said, no, I'm going to die tonight. And they died that evening. There are a number of those cases. There are some where the patient would jump out of bed and crawl under the bed or in the closet because they were afraid, and they said the angel of death was trying to take them. You know, those are just some generalities. But I do know that the two psychologists who did the study, I talked to one of them about the study, and they know the drug history of these people. They know, you know, they know what they had. They have the medical records. And they could check that against those kind of theories. You know, it's just a drug-induced hallucination or something like that. Yes, in the back.
What are some of the arguments of the critics of your evidence?
Well, okay, almost always people who talk about near-death experience concentrate on big numbers and 8 million and 600 and going down corridors and seeing lights and having wonderful experiences, and they concentrate on sameness. How could all these people have seen something similar? And so critiques are often of that, almost always of that kind of response. And I think they deserve to be critiqued. I think, first of all, people don't have the same experiences. What you have is a sliding scale where, contrary to what you can read in popular magazines, maybe only 20% of people see tunnels. Maybe only 50% see lights. So first of all, everybody doesn't see the same thing. And secondly, like I said, a very good critical comeback is this is common biology. You know, if we could stimulate the right temporal lobe and get some of these same experiences, then they're not objective. When you propose the whole new method of talking only about cooperative experiences to build your case, there are virtually no takers by way of critique. Now, sometimes I'll say things like this. Well, you know, stories get bigger with time, and they could have heard people talking after the fact, and maybe if you get them a year later, the story's gotten out of hand, and maybe they did hear somebody say, you know, and those are good responses. People are not necessarily good reporters. But therefore, like with Katie, who comes to, and the doctor's right there in the room reporting those things immediately, a lot of these cases are things that were I think your fourth case is one where a little child reported something right on the spur of the moment about knowing what happened to his mother and Peter, his brother, in a fiery car wreck. And the little boy came to for a minute, and the doctor was sitting by his bed. And she said, "How are you feeling?" And the boy said, "I'm doing okay." And he smiled, and he said, "Mom and Peter said I can come with them." And he died. Well, his mom had died at the site of the accident, but the two boys didn't know that. And the other boy, Peter, had been taken to another burn center, and he was taken to this hospital, so they were separated. And he said, "Mom and Peter said I can come with them." Well, Mom had died, I don't know, an hour, 2 hours, I don't know. She had died earlier. And when the doctor got up and walked past the nurse's station, the nurses said to her, "Doctor, we just got a call from the other hospital. Peter died 10 minutes ago." This little boy. So when you want to get reports that are real fresh, where people don't have time to talk, where they can't listen to things. But that's about the only kind of critique you have, that you know, we are amazingly poor reporters. So you just want to get cases where people report things that are odd, that they wouldn't normally know, that you can check. You want to get them soon before the thing builds up. That's about the only kind of critique I'm aware of, and very few people even say that. There are so many of these things out there, so many of the evidential ones, and some of them are not terribly evidential, some of them are very evidential, that I think just by just weight of the evidence, people are starting to get affected by this. And you have people like A.J. Ayer saying, "I'm still an atheist, but I'm open to life after death now." You know, something beyond the ordinary seems to be going on. I should tell you that the agnostic medical doctor, the guy who had the 7 heart attacks, that guy's a Christian. The agnostic pediatric brain specialist in Washington who saw Katie, he has found like 20 more evidential cases. He is not a Christian, but he is now a theist. He's now a theist. He says there's no question there's a God out there and there's life after death. So here's some examples of professionals who've been moved against their views to another position. So, I mean, I don't want to be dogmatic and say it has to indicate this or that. We can only talk in terms of probabilistic data, but I think it's kind of impressive. But generally, to answer your question real short, people don't normally give evidential cases, and the critics don't respond to the evidential cases. They give and respond to these general cases, which I don't think are evidential anyway. Yes? Like you're supposed to die once or something like that?
Well, I know that there's like, you know, Paul, like for example, the axis from death is kind of related on the death
of the
body. Right. You know, Lazarus is raised from death. I know that parable about the Abraham supposed.
Yeah, same one. Mm-hmm. Okay, question is, what about heaven? What about the Bible? Are there experiences of this kind?
Hard time just tying this into kind of.
Okay. Question is, how do you tie this in with what the Bible has to say? I think you did a very good job. I think there's several cases where there are near-death phenomena reported in the Bible. And you're right. If you go back and look at the timing for Paul's being left for dead outside of Lystra when he was stoned by a crowd of people, and they left him for dead to be buried, and then he wasn't dead. That does work out. He gives the timing in 2 Corinthians 12, where he says, "I know a man 14 years ago," and then he says it was him. He says, well, twice he says, "Whether out of the body or in the body, I know not which, but I went to heaven." That sounds very much like a near-death experience. You've got Stephen in Acts 7, who, when he's rushed out and stoned, he has this, says he saw Jesus standing on the right hand of God. You do have the case you're talking about, Luke 16, where you have the rich man and Lazarus, where there's a little phrase there that's really interesting. And Lazarus, this is not the Lazarus of John 11 who died. It's another man named Lazarus. Lazarus died and was carried by angels to Abraham's bosom. Now just think about that little description. Died, carried angels to a nice place. And you have this experience. I mean, it may or may not be what people are talking about with, you know, experience and that kind of thing. I can think of those cases. And by the way, there are near-death phenomena throughout the world in a number of ancient books. In fact, there's even a near-death experience reported by Plato in Plato's Republic. He gives a quite elaborate case of a soldier who they thought was dead, and they come back on the battlefield to burn these bodies, and the guy's still alive, and the guy talks about seeing souls going to hell and going to heaven. It's in Book 10, I think, of Plato's Republic. There are a number of these in the ancient world, a lot of them. Yes?
Yeah, all these cases you mentioned, they seem to support that there is life after death and that there is a God, but it seems it goes against the Christian doctrine because it sounds like everybody is going to heaven.
Okay, question is, interesting data for life after death and for God, but it looks like it goes against Christianity because everybody's what?
Everybody's experiencing heaven and hell except God. One guy's going to hell.
Okay, well, first of all, everybody's not experiencing. First of all, these people are saying that these are good experiences. We don't know. That's why I keep using heaven in quotes. We don't know if this is heaven or hell. But you don't have to be a Christian to say, have a body that's been thrown out of a car and been in serious pain and serious injury, and then all of a sudden say you're in a state where you're painless. I mean, when people use "I felt wonderful" language, doesn't necessarily mean they were in heaven. But you're right. There are a lot of cases from people who you would not think are Christians who say they have great experiences. We responded to this in detail in both of our books, J.P. Moreland and I. And I'll say this to you too. I gave you one hell case. There's a number of hell cases. In fact, the medical doctor, when that guy passed out seven times and kept saying he was in hell, that medical doctor has theorized that there are a lot more negative experiences. In fact, first of all, he told me himself, he said, I have more hell cases than heaven cases, he told me. Now, to be fair, he's the only guy who says that. But he said he had more hell cases than heaven cases. But he thinks when people don't report anything, many times they could have had negative experiences and don't report them. Like he said, remember he came to the guy a couple days later and said, tell me about this hell thing, and the guy said, I don't remember. He said, come on, you kept talking to me. He said, well, I don't know, I may have said that, but I just don't have any memory of it. The doctor thinks that they were so, you know, I told you his hair was standing up on end. He thinks the guy was so scared he may have blocked it out. But there are a lot of reasons people can report good experiences. I'll be glad if you want to come up. I'll be glad to go into detail with you and give you some options. There's a number of things I could say. I can't go on too much longer, but I will give you, some of you have to go to class, I understand, and I got to end this pretty soon. But I'll be glad to chat with you if you want some specific details. We give three or four specific responses, other responses beyond the ones I just gave. Somebody else? Yes. Any other first-time callers? Okay. Looks like Chuck.
Based on the doctrine of those who have fallen asleep in 1 Thessalonians 4, there's people that have fallen asleep, it says, in Christ,
yes,
and some that haven't, and then there's the dead in Christ. Like, I've heard of some people, like, their doctrine is that everybody, when they die, they fall asleep, and they go into a place where time does not continue, but they don't even realize they're asleep or whatever, and then, like, at the end times or whatever, when everybody goes to heaven, and they all go at the same time.
You talk about the New Testament, right?
Yeah.
Okay, what about souls and sleeping and a place where there's no time? And first of all, the Bible doesn't say anything about a place where there's no time, but sleep is used about a half dozen times in the New Testament. It's always used of believers, and it always, where distinctions are, where the question's answered, it always refers to a bodily state, never to a spirit state. Stephen, for example. Stephen falls asleep, and his spirit goes to God. So that's the Old Testament, too. Ecclesiastes 12:7 says your body returns to the ground and the spirit returns to God who gave it. The predominant Christian view is that the intermediate state, the state between death and resurrection, is a bodiless, possibly timeless state. You hinted at that. Possibly timeless, but a bodiless state where people are conscious and it's positive. Paul says, absent from the body, present with the Lord. He says that in 2 Corinthians 5. In Philippians 1, he says, I prefer to be dead and be with Christ. That's better by far. And this is the same Paul who was left for dead, who may have had a near-death experience, like that lady who said she preferred to be in heaven. Paul said it was very good, better than this life. He said, I groan for that, but it's not the final state. It's a bodiless state. That's just a quick answer. Okay, maybe one more. Did I get your second one? Go ahead. Same question? Okay, what about the resurrection of the
dead? I was kind of wondering, too, about when the Bible talks about
right. That's a re-embodied time. Yeah, Paul has an intermediate state in 2 Corinthians 5. He has a re-embodied state in 1 Corinthians 15 and other places. So typical, there are exceptions, but typical Christian scholarship is that the New Testament hope is a bodiless hope followed by an embodied state. Peter Kraft, professor of philosophy at Boston College, he's a Thomist. But he says about the intermediate state, I love this quote, he says, Plato's right as far as he went. In other words, that he agrees with Plato that the initial state is bodiless. He disagrees with Plato that that's the, being an Aristotelian, he disagrees that that's the final state. Okay, one more real quick. Go ahead.
What was people's reaction when they got to that point in the stream or whatever, and then they weren't allowed to go beyond that? I mean, was that discouraging?
Yeah. Almost always they want to cross. Almost always they want to stay. And when they come back, they're not afraid to die. That's just general rule. In one study done by a psychologist, University of Connecticut, every person who had a near-death experience said they did not fear death. Every person who had one. Most people don't get close enough to walk across that stream. That's the deeper the case, the more they report. You don't want to say it this way, but I mean, the more dead you are, the more they reported going further in. And they were. I do know one person who claims to have crossed that river, creek, whatever, and was allowed to come back anyway. No, one person who claims that. But that's just a claim. And like I said, the heaven, those kind of things are heaven or not evidenced. What I mean is they're nice, they're really neat stories. And this woman over here at the doctor's conference, she captivated everybody by telling that, but it was not evidential. Thanks.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.